It's Wednesday, September 30th, 2015, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, freelancing out the editorial page. A short-staffed St. Louis Post-Dispatch pays a private company to write editorials on behalf of the paper. Now that Pope Francis's five-day visit to the United States and Cuba is over, we'll look back at a week's worth of wall-to-wall coverage. And there's more excitement and celebrations at KBIA. We'll tell you about the latest honor bestowed upon the team. There's a whole lot more that hopefully we'll get to as well, but let's start with a rather unfortunate incident that happened last week while Jews around the globe were marking Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. Wednesday, the staff at Chicago's WGN-TV found itself apologizing for something that ran during Tuesday night's late-night newscast. Here are Tom Negevin and Micah Mater.
Take a moment to apologize again for an error on last night's broadcast. We ran a story to recognize Yom Kippur, the Jewish Day of Atonement.
Regrettably, we failed to recognize that the artwork we chose to accompany that story contained an offensive symbol. This was an unfortunate mistake. Ignorance is not an excuse, and we are extremely embarrassed and deeply apologize to our viewers and to the Jewish community for this mistake.
The mistake, a graphic over Negevin's shoulder, with an image of a yellow Star of David and the word Jude, German for Jew. Millions of Jews across Europe were forced by the Nazis to wear that badge during World War II. During the 28-second story, there was no mention of the on-screen graphic, and there was no other graphic included. News director Jennifer Lyons and general manager Gregory Easterly issued several apologies, saying that there are investigations underway to figure out where editorial processes broke down, allowing this, quote, horrible error to make it on air. And according to station statements, the image has reportedly been removed from the station's graphics bank, and all newsroom employees will undergo training and Holocaust education sessions put on by the Simon Wiesenthal Center. There's also now a link to that center permanently on WGN-TV's website, WGNTV.com. I have to agree with Jennifer Lyons, who is a former colleague and friend of mine, when she called this a horrible error. But on some levels, I can see how something like this might happen.
Yeah, I mean, my guess, and it's only a guess, I don't know if we'll ever learn the details, but you had some producer or graphics editor who was in a hurry. They go and enter some generic keywords like Jewish or whatever into their graphics bank. It pulls up the first thing. They look at something. Oh, hey, that's really easy to see on screen. It's simple. They didn't have any knowledge or history about what that symbol meant, and they just tossed it out there. And that's probably what happened, or at least that's what would happen in many newsrooms. It doesn't excuse what they did, though.
Well, I mean, this can happen a lot in newsrooms, not just in television newsrooms, but newsrooms of all sorts, when you don't have staff who understand historical context of certain images they use, of certain phrases they use, words they use. We talk about this, we talk about context all the time. Well, this story is another example of not having that proper context. And it could be a rush situation like Mike described, but still there should have been someone there. But quite often you have staffs that don't have that knowledge.
Well, right. And newsrooms are places where you have people coming from all different parts of the countries, working in of all different ages, all different experience levels, both professionally and in terms of personal life experience, and maybe not having some of that cultural understanding. So I guess I would ask to you, and I would even ask this of myself, as journalism educators, what are the teaching and learning moments to come out of this?
Well, this goes well beyond journalism educators down to what we teach about history in our public schools. I mean, for a long time, American kids have not really done well on tests of history. And, you know, something like the Holocaust, everyone should understand.
Interestingly enough, I had remembered growing up in the state of Illinois that Holocaust education was something that was a regular occurrence. And I was doing a little bit of research and found that in 1989, the state of Illinois was actually the second of five to require Holocaust education and genocide education on both the elementary school level and the high school level. But again, that's five states out of 50 that require that.
Yeah. And I mean, it sort of goes back to the fact that, you know, when they begin to look at the curriculum, in high school and even in college, you know, things are put in, things are taken out. A lot of it depends on how much time you have, but also more and more it's the political atmosphere where you begin to have certain things in history that aren't taught, certain things in history that are reinterpreted. And this is a battle that's been going on for years. And right now we're still having that battle, especially when it comes to talking about the civil rights history, when it comes to talking about women's rights history and that sort of thing. So you're having those battles right now. And this can happen. These kinds of mistakes can happen when you aren't teaching history in its full capacity.
Here's another thing for me. Maybe it's a broader issue. I mean, this was a very specific mistake. And for them to engage the Wiesenthal Center and for them to say they were going to do more diversity training for their staff around this is appropriate. But, you know, it says something larger to me, and that's in terms of how journalists tend to not know much about or to shy away from covering religion as it affects people's actual personal lives. I mean, Americans, for the most part, are a religious group of people. Journalists are less so. And so they tend, unless there's a politics of religion story, they don't tend to do very much with it. But, you know, just last week at the same time we had this terrible era with Yom Kippur, it was also the Islamic holy day of Eid al-Adha. Were there any stories in most media around the country about that at all? Were any stories at all about religious communities divorced from politics?
The stories that you saw regarding Eid had to do with the, most of them having to do with the stampede at it. For Hajj and Mecca.
Right. And the problem
is not about the holiday so much as something spot news that happened in marking of that holiday.
And the problem we have when it comes journalists have when it comes to covering religion is that they're so afraid of getting it wrong. They're so afraid of offending that they sort of stay away from it instead of educating themselves and learning what the necessary things you need to know about those particular religions so that you can cover them in a way that actually shows the way in which people live their lives around their religion and how the religion is a part of their lives. We shy away from those things because we say they're too complicated and we don't have enough time to really explain it. Well, it's not about explaining. It's about being able to show, you know, how people have incorporated and how religion is a huge part of their lives. Yeah.
Well, so there was another one of those quick teaching moments with another story last week. The lesson to come out of that one, slow down. It happened shortly after the death of baseball great Yogi Berra. The Yankee Hall of Famer died at the age of 90. But if you looked at early versions of his obituary from the Associated Press, it said that the Hall of Fame catcher Yogi Bear had died. You know, the Hanna-Barbera cartoon character from the Huckleberry Hound show. Sure, people have been laughing at this. It's something that it's a mistake that's been made since, you know, the late 1950s when the cartoon character was first created. But we would expect better from the Associated Press, especially for Yogi Bear's obit, no?
I suppose so. And it got amplified by the fact that so many digital sources just took this content and automatically threw it up with the same headline. But, you know, I kind of love this. I mean, for a certain generation of people like us, you know, I mean, Yogi Bear and Boo Boo, I mean, these were great characters. And if you think about that headline, it's exactly the kind of malapropism that would have come out of Yogi Bear's mouth.
Wait, it's almost along the lines of if there's a fork in the road, take it.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure somewhere, you know, he's looking down and going like, okay, I wish I had come up with that one. You know, it's one of those things where, again, probably someone rushing through and not paying attention to what they're doing, and then it pops up there. I mean, I see this over and over again. I mean, if you read a lot of online material like we do, you're going to find those mistakes almost every day. I would say that the copy editing, now that we've moved a lot of things to digital, is not nearly as close as
you're talking about that, and you bring it up. There is another possible explanation, and it's something we have all at some point been burned by. Maybe it was an autocorrect thing, you know.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, a computer automatically changed Berra to Bear, and as someone was hitting send.
I mean, I think we also ought to say, I mean, even though Hanna-Barbera cartoons always denied that Yogi Bear was based on Yogi Berra, because Yogi Berra threatened a lawsuit at one point. Yeah. Everybody knows that that cartoon character was based on the baseball player. And so it's kind of fun that that happened. I will say on a semi-serious note, you should check out the New York Times obituary for Yogi Berra if you haven't read it yet. If you want to see that he was more than just kind of a mumbling, bumbling kind of good fella, he was a fabulous baseball player, one of the best catchers ever. And that's a really good obituary to read if you want to know something more about
it. And after his career, he was, you know, he was known for his phrases, but his humanitarianism is really comes out in that obituary too. Yeah. So I think that that would be a very good read.
Okay, well, there's no way that we could have a weekly media criticism program without talking about the big story of the week, Pope Francis's visit to Washington, New York, and Philadelphia. The cable networks went wall-to-wall for 5 days. MSNBC brought back Brian Williams in a strategically timed move. If you were to watch Chris Cuomo on CNN, the only word that could come to mind to describe his coverage was just downright giddy. Thoughts on things that you saw during the course of the week?
Well, I think it's one of those things where whenever you have a figure like this come to the United States, and you have 24/7 news, it's going to be wall to wall. Overall,
and it was overall.
I think they did a good job of really telling his story or allowing him to tell his story to the public at large. I mean, they tried not to over politicize it, even though there were some political elements in it. His meeting with the president, the vice president, his speech to Congress, Boehner's resignation that happened the day after he spoke to Congress. So you had politics involved, but overall, it was about the Pope and his agenda and what he was trying to do.
And the politics involved are still coming out. This morning, we hear from Kim Davis that she met with the Pope and the Vatican's response.
I think that's a very interesting story because, you know, you had people on both sides of the political divide trying to use the Pope's visit for their own motives. But it was interesting to me that the Pope met privately with Kim Davis, the Kentucky clerk who refused to give licenses to gay couples, for example. But the Vatican never talked about that until after he was out of the country. In fact, it might not have come out had not the people providing the legal representation for Kim Davis put out a press release about it. And so then the Pope's spokespeople were asked about it on the plane as he's going back to Italy. And basically he's saying, you know, I think religious freedom is it's a civil right, a moral right. And he apparently embraced her. She gave him a gift. I mean, if that had come out during the time he was on American soil, I wonder what the media narrative would have been then.
Yeah, I would think that the media narrative probably would have played out much differently and probably much more, definitely much more politicized than it was, and maybe not as welcoming from a certain part of the United States and of the media had that story come out while he was still here.
I mean, I think, you know, in some ways this is representative of the fact that the Pope is a very complicated person trying to straddle this divide. I mean, you heard a lot of stories about it, but he takes positions and the Catholic Church has dogma which, you know, can please people on the left and on the right. And it seemed to me that the media, the mainstream legacy media, focused a lot more on the messages he gave that resonated with the political left, whether it was about, you know, global warming or immigration or helping the poor, and maybe a little bit less on those areas of Catholic faith where he may be taking a more sort of genial or humane approach to it, but where women in the church, not so much. Okay. And the whole business about accepting gays and lesbians, maybe not so much.
Yeah, the one thing that really surprised me was that he came and he talked about the scandal in the church involving the priests. And that wasn't covered as much as I thought it was going to be, because he really actually talked to the American bishops about that, and there were some stories out there, but not it didn't get as much play as I thought.
Do you think part of that might have been because it was towards the tail end of things, and perhaps there was some fatigue on the part of the media a little bit, and it was easier to maybe track with some of the easier things that were going on there?
I'm not, to be honest with you, I'm not sure why that was the case, but I'm just saying that I was surprised that it didn't get much play because the American media spent a lot of time covering that and exposing a lot of what happened, exposing that. And then for him to come here, talk about it the way that he did and not get the coverage was kind of surprising.
One of the things that did kind of surprise, it didn't surprise me that he got the 24/7 treatment. This was a much more relevant story for 24/7 treatment than the cruise ship from hell or Donald Trump. Any other thing we could talk about.
There you go.
About.
You got your Donald Trump.
On the other hand, I thought it was kind of interesting, the exception to the rule, in that we had journalists who were coming out. I mean, big name journalists, Chris Cuomo, Brian Williams, Chris Matthews, lesser known journalists like CNN's Rosa Flores, who were basically wearing their Catholicism on their sleeves.
And there are some links that are on our links blog that you have to dig into a little bit that show video of Chris Cuomo pretty much running after the Pope mobile and trying to get the Pope's attention himself. And even saying, I was saying as we started getting into this topic, that he was downright giddy because he was as upfront about it as possible, that this was also a once-in-a-lifetime experience for him, too, and he was soaking it in as a Catholic.
And it leads me to a really interesting discussion that was going on at the Online News Association conference out in L.A. this past week while the Pope was in the U.S. And this was there's a new code of ethics that the ONA is – well, it's not a single code of ethics, but basically you can create your own from a list of modules and questions you want to ask your newsroom. And one of the sessions we were at talked about some of the case studies for ethics, and one of them revolved around whether or not if you were a television reporter and you wanted to wear a yarmulke or a hijab or a big cross on the air, would that be okay? And it turned out that the people in the room, you know, the choices were kind of like, yeah, that's fine. I mean, it's an expression of her culture and we should respect that. All the way down to no, really, that gives off the impression of bias or conflict of interest. And you'd think people would kind of be split on that. All the journalists in that room who were willing to give their opinion said, hey, live with it, people. This is an expression of diversity, of authenticity, whatever, and we should just roll with it. And I found that a little bit surprising in that opinions about that have changed so much in the past few years, I think.
Well, I think part of the reason for that is in order to be able to get stories from people, you're going to have to be able to connect with them. Mm-hmm. And our propensity as journalists to sort of step back and not really
create
engage and create
that
distance sort of makes it difficult for us to get those authentic stories. And I think if we're more willing to talk about ourselves and be ourselves in the presence of people we're trying to get stories from, we stand a better chance. I think that's where some of that is coming from.
Yeah.
Well, so it's not all that unusual for a publication to freelance out articles, to hire someone to cover a story. We see it with high school sports, with local government reporting. We see it a lot with feature stories. Reporters get paid by the story instead of working for a salary and benefits. Something else we see a lot of in the opinion pages, op-eds written by members of the general public. For example, remember Angelina Jolie's piece in the New York Times about why she chose to have a double mastectomy. But something we don't often see, freelance editorials, opinion pieces that represent the newspaper's editorial board or publisher. That's why a piece in Sunday's St. Louis Post-Dispatch about the place of the middle class in the economic recovery has some people talking. It was written by a group that's called Opinions in a Pinch. It was written by this group, edited by the editorial board, and published in the paper. The Post-Dispatch has an explanation for this.
Well, yeah, they're basically saying that they're down people. Mm-hmm. I mean, Tony Messenger, who was the head of their editorial board, has now moved over to be a columnist. So,
and he's also out for a while undergoing cancer treatment.
He's out, exactly. And so now they're, instead of having a staff of, I think, according to their explanation, they used to have a staff of about 12 people a couple of years ago. Now they're down to a staff of 4. And 2 of those are sort of part-time being shared with others in the newsroom. So they're sort of scrambling to try to do the work with fewer people, and this is one way for them to do that. I'm not quite sure this is the best way to make to do that, but at least they're giving a good explanation, and you're starting to see this all over the newsroom, not just in editorial pages.
Do you think the readership cares as much as the journalism community?
I don't really know. I think that newspapers, generally speaking, have put more stock in the power of their editorials than the public does for many, many years. But it is interesting that a sort of a proud local institution like a local newspaper like this has to stoop to. And I'm not trying to say anything bad about the people who wrote it. In fact, the people who wrote it for this company you talked about, mm-hmm. one of them is a former editorial writer for the Roanoke Virginia Times, a very respectable paper. The other one was Miriam Pepper, who was the editorial page editor for the Kansas City Star for a long time. So these people have, you know, credentials for writing them. On the other hand, what kind of worries me about this sort of freelancing it out, these individuals aren't just writing ghost editorials for newspapers that need them in a pinch. They're also writing ghost-written commentaries for politicians, business people, advocacy organizations. And do news media want to be associated with companies that are doing that kind of work as well?
I mean, to me, it's one of those things where it's sort of the news content is being subcontracted out. And you get the product in and you can fiddle with it, as they say they have. They get to massage it. They get to change whatever. And then they decide whether or not they want to put it in. But you're still the bulk of the work is still being done by someone from the outside. And you need to be transparent about that process and everything else so that people know that this is coming. But it's still your name on it. So ultimately, you're responsible.
I also will say, you know, at the top of the editorial, and they've had several other editorials written by these folks, it says by the editorial board. Mm-hmm. Down at the bottom, it says sort of a vague statement about freelancers doing it, but they don't name who those freelancers are or what company they work for. It was only after they were asked about it by others that they gave that explanation.
We interrupt this edition of Views of the News for this public service announcement. Okay, maybe that wasn't exactly my smoothest segue, but seriously, listen to this, because while it's meant to be a joke, there's a bit of truth to it.
Enough is enough.
It's time.
It's time.
It's time you stop using our HBO Go password.
Get your own account.
We love you, but we've supported you long enough. You're ready to go out on your own.
You're an adult. You can figure out how to watch TV yourself.
You can watch the rest of that on our links blog. It is funny. But as someone who has an HBO Go account and has shared it, it made me laugh. The reason why I broke out this video that was produced a couple weeks ago is it does kind of play in line with a study that's come out in the past week or so that shows that millennials are interested in news, but they're not prepared to pay for it, and they're not willing to do so either.
Yeah, I'll say, first of all, I've benefited in a few times from your old HBO Go account.
You're a big fan of the Game of Thrones.
I got it, my own HBO account, and it wasn't, you know, a couple of days after that where my kids were using it for free. So I get that. But, you know, it is interesting. This study, it said, you know, millennials are not all alike. Well, gee, that's true. Mm-hmm. They broke them down into these four categories: the unattached and the distracted, who are the ones who just kind of bump into news and don't really care about it. And then the explorers and the activists who seek out news, but only that last group actually seeks it out and pays for it in large numbers. And so basically the lesson is, except for a small fraction of millennials, they won't pay for news. And that means they won't pay for it through a subscription. And more, they won't pay for it by being exposed to advertising. Not only do they block advertising on the web, but now there's a big controversy and worry about ad-blocking software on mobile devices, because that could take away a huge new source of revenue for news companies.
Well, I think this goes back to things that we've talked about on the show before, which is when you give it away for free and then you want people to pay for it.
Not going to happen.
That's not going to happen. And this study points directly to that. For their entire lives, at least the part that they've been engaged in media, they've been getting it for free. And now all of a sudden you have companies that are like HBO Go, New York Times, Washington Post, who are basically saying, well, we'll give you 10 for free, and then after that you're going to have to pay. And they're basically saying, no, we're not going to do that. We'll get it somewhere else, or we won't get it at all.
It's also why news organizations now are resorting to more ethically challenged ways of raising money, like, you know, branded content or native advertising, whatever you want to call
it. Or events,
right?
Where they're doing live
or
events.
Or even in some instances where they are including product placements in articles and then directing people to buy stuff, which they get a cut from. So all of those are a lot more ethically challenging than advertising or subscriptions,
fact,
but that's what they're leaning
in
on.
In fact, I don't know if you've noticed, but in the last maybe week or two, the Columbia Daily Tribune, also on its homepage, now has sponsored content.
Yeah,
so,
yeah. I mean, and
that's one of those 10 articles, and then you're blocked.
Exactly, but that's the way they're going to have to go, and I think it's going to take maybe another, I don't know, half a generation to sort of wean them off and to go back in the other direction. But once they put that out there for free, it's going to be hard to move that back, and whether or not they're really going to want to get the news in the way in which they've been getting it. So that's something we've been dealing with.
And as we've said over and over and over again, news that is a commodity, which people would pay for in the past because they had no choice, they won't pay for commodity news anymore. It's got to be tailored to them, personalized to them, have a particular relevance or value to them as individuals, not as groups.
Okay. Well, before we go, I want to take a minute to offer another hearty congratulations to the KBIA team on another national award, this one from the Online News Association.
And the winner is KBIA.org, KBIA News.
Saturday night, Mike, you and Dean David Kirpius accepted the Online Journalism Award on behalf of KBIA in the General Excellence category for the Small Market Division. This caps off an incredible year for KBIA.
And, you know, David Kirpius, the dean, and I, what we really were saying when we were at the back of the room when this was announced was, holy, you know what, because we had no idea that this was going to happen.
I said the same thing sitting at home watching the live stream.
But this really is a big deal because this was one of the three top awards that this organization gives. And this organization is the preeminent representative of journalists, not just digital journalists, but journalists around the country. There were more than 2,000 people here. We were competing against very venerable online operations like the Texas Tribune and the MinnPost. And for KBIA to win, as they said in announcing it, with a tiny newsroom staffed mostly by students, that's a pretty big deal.
Yeah, I want to congratulate KBIA. And as members of the KBIA family doing views of the news, I just want to say that they work very hard. The students put in a lot of work and the staff put in a lot of work. And you see it every day. I mean, you hear it every day. And you see it online every day. And I think, you know, we get used to it.
Because we're part of the process every day. It's just doing work.
Yeah, it is. And so when you get recognized, you sort of stand back and go like, wow, you know, we actually did that, or we're capable of doing that. And then you go back to the grind. And I think sometimes it's good to sort of come up and sort of look around and say, hey, you know, we are doing some really good work.
I think it's good to point out just for a second, too, I mean, the actual work that was valued by the ONA. I mean, in Ryan Famuliner, our news director, who put together the package that was submitted with this application, focused on some projects that were really, I think, very innovative, like Hearsay, which you can hear on KBIA, but which is also online with a map that shows you people telling their own stories. Heartland, Missouri. We had a documentary, an online documentary about special education in the state of Missouri, on and on. And one of the things I can't help but reference, as I did in remarks out in California, is that we have a group of students here in the journalism school who are not, quote, broadcast students, but who are what we call convergent students or multimedia students.
There are journalism babies. There are kids.
In every one of those examples I just mentioned, there was a convergence journalism student who was a central character, a reporter, an editor, a producer on every one of those pieces.
And it's holds a special place in our heart when we're able to see that their work be recognized.
And it says something about what we need to continue to do, you know, in journalism education generally, is to put more and more of a focus on multimedia, cross-platform journalism, train students who can do all of the, not digital add-ons. Add-ons is kind of an old legacy way of thinking about it, but digital is the focus. Mobile is the focus. Interactive graphics and video are the focus.
Every week I work with students now where we have them write a 30-second teaser for KBIA, and that it's a digitally centered product.
But I think one of the most important things is that they're out there telling stories about people in Missouri. Yeah. And without that, we wouldn't be able to do all the other things, people telling us their stories.
Okay, well, that music means we're out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about the topics we talked about today on our links blog. That's under the programs tab at KBIA.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @viewsonKBIA. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, to leave us comments or questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Thanks to Travis McMillan and Maya Jackson for directing today's show. KBIA's Pat Akers handled the audio, and Claire Banderas is our associate producer. I'm Amy Simons. We'll see you again next week.